as I said, things progressively got worse throughout that time. Often I'd be in a situation where all my money would be gone and I'd be lying to people or borrowing money or not going out to a social event or something because I had no money but I had a great job, so it didn't match up. So it started to change me as a character. And as things got worse, I started self-harming. So I remember going to my mom's house, going up to my bedroom, and my first reaction was to just start punching myself in the head. It's not just the harm that it causes the individual, Rob. For every person that suffers with gambling addiction, there's going to be 6 to 9 people that are also impacted or indirectly impacted, I should say, whether that be mom, dad, guardian, brothers, family, friends, etc. But then the impacts on economy as well, when you can prove that people are taking their own lives from this product and you're not advertising the harm.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the ODAT Gambling Awareness Podcast. My name's Rob and today's guest is Aaron from Against the Odds, which is an organization in the United Kingdom that focuses on raising awareness about gambling addiction, gambling harms, and trying to prevent people from getting hooked to gambling. Aaron, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Good to see you, mate. All well?
Yeah, appreciate it. Doing well, of course, of course. And I hope you're doing well also. We finally found the time to get this recording laid down. So I think that for people in maybe America that haven't heard of Against the Odds yet, what is it exactly that you do and why did you start the organization?
So there's three arms to Against the Odds: education, awareness, and recovery. So our education workshops are mainly aimed at 16 to 24-year-olds, giving them a first-hand story of addiction, which is myself, that struggled with a gambling addiction for over a decade. We've then got the awareness side, which is raising awareness of gambling-related harm throughout young people. And we've then got our recovery side, which helps individuals take back control, not just from gambling, but across the addiction sort of landscape. And that's our sort of newest addition to the business, really. So yeah, three arms, mate. Education, in terms of our workshops and programs we deliver, and they go into secondary schools, colleges, universities, up to professional sports clubs, international rugby clubs, etc. The awareness side, which is all about raising awareness of gambling-related harm for young people, and then the recovery side, helping individuals take back control from a number of different addictions.
Yeah, prevention, awareness, and recovery are actually like the three pillars of what I do here on my channel. And so I thought there was like a really clear overlap in the work that we were
definitely
doing.
Definitely. So,
very happy to have you here. Why don't we jump into it? What's your story of gambling-related harm?
So I started gambling at 16 when I went off to college. So I was okay at school, but I wouldn't say I was particularly very good. Didn't get the GCSEs or the grades that I needed to stay on. The plan was for me to become a sports teacher, PE teacher, sports lecturer, and that kind of remit. So I went off to college, studied sport, went off to university, carried on studying sport. But it was at college that I placed my first bet when I was 16. Two mates took me into it. So yeah, I went into a bookies with two friends. And I remember having £5 note on me that was to get my mum had given me to get dinner. And as soon as I got into the bookmakers, I'd just seen the roulette machine. I thought, oh, I'll have a go on that. So I remember putting a fiver in. I actually remember black 17 coming in. I had no money on it. And I remember as I was turned around to walk out, what was going through my mind was, I shouldn't be in here. I'm 2 years under the legal age. I'm annoyed now, so I can't get any dinner. I don't even know how to play this machine, etc. And it was actually on the way out of the shop that I heard two elderly men talking about football. And it was the Villa-Arsenal game. And being a huge Villa fan, I heard one guy say that Thierry Henry wasn't playing and he was going to have money on Villa. And I thought, oh, hang on a minute. I don't know a thing about roulette, but I've got a season ticket at Villa. I play FIFA, I play Football Manager. And as a 16-year-old, naively, I'm thinking, oh, I know about football. So I remember just literally staring over this guy's shoulder and watching him fill out a football accumulator, home, draw, away, etc. And started to take slips home, started gambling sort of £2 to £5 a week on the football. Things then progressively got worse. In the UK, they introduced something called EMA, which the last Labour government introduced it, and it was educational maintenance allowance. So if your parents didn't earn a certain amount of money or has hit a certain threshold, then if your attendance was 100% for a week, the following week, the government would put 30 quid in your bank account. So then there was about 7 or 8 of us that would all make sure we wouldn't miss any lessons, straight to the cash point at lunchtime on a Friday. We'd all get 30 quid out and we'd all gamble it on the roulettes. Then as I went on to university, started to get worse progressively. So the thing for me, and this is why we target our work to 16 to 24-year-olds, is the transition of further education to higher education, so college to university, is often met with what I call the two Fs: more finance, more freedom. Why more finance? Because if you do the experience properly, as people say, you will have a student loan, you'll have a maintenance grant, you'll have a part-time job, you might have family giving you money, etc. If you more freedom, because if you move away, you haven't got that guardian or parent saying where you're going, who you're with, blah, blah, blah. So for me, I started gambling with my student loan, started missing lessons, and there were a number of things sort of built up, and I ended up pulling out of the university course 3 or 4 months before I actually got my qualification. Majority of that was down to gambling, how much money I was wasting, but there were other sort of elements that factored into it. So I'd effectively studied sport for 5.5 years, and we're now at a position where I was at a crossroads in my life and didn't really know what I was going to do because I had no qualification. At the time when I left university, I knew I had an issue. I knew I had a problem. But 15 years ago, if you told somebody you had a gambling addiction, you'd often be met with the response, "Stop gambling, you idiot," or "What are you doing? Stop wasting your money." So it's very different back then to how I imagine it would be now. But I got a job in recruitment because that was a sector I could get involved with that didn't require. I know in America it's a very professional industry. It's not quite as professional in the UK, but I could enter that with no barrier of entry, no qualification. And if I sort of backed myself, I was good on the phone, good at sales, talking to people, you can make good money. And I did make really good money. However, my gambling again got worse. And I was in a situation where 2 weeks into the month, my whole salary would be gone. And then you're telling lies to people. You're behaving differently. You're almost out of character because of your addiction. As I said, things progressively got worse throughout that time. Often I'd be in a situation where all my money would be gone and I'd be lying to people or borrowing money or not going out to a social event or something because I had no money but I had a great job, so it didn't match up. So it started to change me as a character. And as things got worse, I started self-harming. So I remember going to my mom's house, going up to my bedroom, and my first reaction was to just start punching myself in the head. And I tell students this now, and we'll always get a few that will laugh in the classroom. And I would have probably been one of them in the classroom that would have been like, "You used to hit yourself." But that's what I would do. I was unable to communicate. I was unable to talk about things. I don't think my dad was particularly good at opening up. And I think a lot of males are probably the same, actually. They don't want to voice their concerns and their issues. They'd rather sort of brush them under the carpet, pretend they don't exist and move on. And rather than talk about it and get things off my chest, because again, I had a great relationship with my mom and didn't feel I could talk to my mom openly about gambling, probably because of the stigma and the shame that come with potentially being an addict at that time. And just started punching myself in the head, started pulling my hair out. I would smash laptops. I would just acting aggressively, but let build things up and then just lose my head. And it wasn't long after that I remember walking home from work because I had no money. I'd gambled it all away. And I remember just Googling the best way to take your own life, because it got to a point where it was 7, 8, 9 years in. I just couldn't understand why I had a good job. I had great friends, great family around me. Why I just could not stop gambling. And the thing I used to say to myself is, tomorrow I'll stop. I won't get help for it. Tomorrow I'll stop. And tomorrow did come, but it came 12 years too late. And then I got to a point after that where I sort of just broke down eventually and to my mom and just come clean about everything and opened up. And I mean, tried to cover a big 12-year span there quite quickly, but I think the main things to look at are the progression of how things got worse and how it could have been tackled at a younger age. Mm-hmm. I say to people now, my biggest regret isn't losing £263,000, because that's what I lost. It's not opening up to my mom at 18 years of age when I knew I potentially had an issue and could have maybe dealt with it then. So yeah, and there's bits and bobs that I've missed there, Rob. Like, I did start gambling anonymous for a short amount of time before I started self-harming. I remember saying to my mom that I was gambling too much, didn't tell her the full extent, didn't go into any detail, just said I was gambling too much on the football. We went to a number of sessions, then I said everything was all right and carried on. And yeah, it was a real battle, mate. But I think the one thing I want to point out, which I think is very relevant today, is if you were to look at my social media from when I was younger, so my Instagram account, for example, there was this guy going on flash holidays. There was this, it looked like I had this fantastic lifestyle. But the difference between what was portrayed on my social media to how I was actually feeling were worlds apart. And that was one of the key drivers behind when I got into a year into my own recovery, setting against the odds up. There are hundreds of thousands of young people in the same situation I was in that are now being targeted more than when I was gambling. And we don't seem to be doing a great deal about it, apart from continually to advertise this product aggressively. So, yeah, I felt that I could use my experience to give back to that younger demographic, so hopefully they don't face the same sort of issues.
Throughout the rest of this podcast, there's two things that I really want to accomplish. One is I want you to be able to illustrate kind of what made the difference for you as you left gambling in the past, and to kind of bring to life what your organization does on a day-to-day basis. But before we dive into that, you know, I was writing and taking notes as you were talking, and there were a few things that popped up that I think we should kind of highlight before we do move on. The first thing is, it seemed like as you would earn more money, as you would develop what would be a better financial position without the gambling, it would lead to increased gambling. Do you feel like basically the more you earned, the more you wanted to bet? And if so, like, for someone that doesn't have a gambling addiction, make that make sense to them? You know, you're earning more money. Why do you feel like you have to bet more money?
It's a very, very good question. Very good question. But I think when you're an addict, it doesn't matter if you're on minimum wage or you've got the best job in the world, you will gamble what you can afford. And for me, one of the reasons I probably entered the recruitment market was because I was potentially, if I was any good and I was to get my head down and learn my trade, I was in a position where I could almost be, what the effort I'd put in would then match in terms of what I'd get financially. Sure. And as I obviously started to earn more money, my betting stayed the same for a little while. But then when you lost a bet and you had so much extra in the bank, you're thinking, well, hang on a minute, I either go again here or I'll start to up the stakes a little bit to hopefully see some more money back in return. So I would say that, yes, to anyone that doesn't struggle with gambling or anyone that is a social gambler and doesn't face any harm from it, to tell someone that you'd gamble what you can afford might sound slightly odd, but that is your addiction taking over. Yeah. It is your addiction saying, well, you've still got money in your account, keep going. If you think about a social gambler will celebrate a win. Mm. You think, when I was in the full grips of addiction, I would never celebrate a win. I almost knew where that winnings was going straight away on the next bet and the next bet and so forth and so on. So it's just a massively different type of feeling from being a social gambler and someone that can put £10 on a football accumulator at the weekend. And if one team lets you down, you think, damn, but I can wait till next week. A gambling addict can't. A gambling addict has to go again on the 5:30 kickoff and then see what other events are on throughout the night and then go again on the Sunday football. So I think it's quite a tricky one to answer, but the best way of describing it is, if you've got the funds there, you're going to gamble it because you're addicted to the product. Yeah. You can't just say, well, no, I'll keep that for a rainy day, because it doesn't happen. In your head, you will be thinking, right, I need to go again. I need to go again and again and again until I'm chasing that loss, or until I'm trying to get a certain amount of money back, or whatever it will be. But I think, to summarize, whatever you've got available to you when you're an addict, you will gamble. And that's the unfortunate reality of it.
Yeah, it's fuel. I mean, it's just fuel to make that next bet, to keep that high going. But, you know, one thing you just said there is, like, you picked a job that was theoretically, you know, a higher risk, but for a higher payout. And I find, looking back, that I was really dissatisfied with the jobs that I worked because I knew how much money I would make from them. I don't know if that makes sense, but the idea of stability is very different to me than I think it is to a normal, like, normally functioning person. If stability is, like, almost an unappealing thing for me to an extent. I don't know if you can relate to that at all. It was like I lacked motivation to work hard because I knew how much I would make regardless, and I never wanted to be in that position again.
Definitely, mate. I mean, I was in education recruitment, so I was responsible for putting teachers and lecturers into schools and colleges. Now, that type of recruitment is seasonal. For example, you're not going to make any money June, July, August because there's summer holidays. You're not going to make money at Easter or at Christmas. But my gambling would get progressively worse on them spells where the education weeks were in. So I knew I was making money on them weeks. And I'd do 60, 70 hours a week sometimes, mate. I'd put a proper graft in, like it was my own recruitment company, in terms of my reputation and how much hard work I'd put in. But I knew that the financials that would come at the end of it would be significant for me to gamble with. And as bad as that sounds, and I mean, you've been there yourself, bro, so you know, but I'd not want to take the girlfriend out for a 50 quid meal, but would be willing to put a 250 quid double on the football. It's just absurd, really, when you think about it now.
It really is. I mean, the mental gymnastics needed to accomplish something like that, but it was what we did every day. So it's crazy to think about. But another thing that you had mentioned I wanted to highlight, because a lot of my viewers are typically, you know, 24 to 35 years old. It's gotten a little bit older as we've done the podcast. I guess the younger demographic doesn't want to sit and listen to me for so long. But as it's gotten a little older, it's just like, still, when we move into a university setting, when we move into that first job that we get coming out of university, or we pick up trade work or whatever it is, the first time that we have that freedom, what should someone in that position try to be thinking about, try to be internalizing about gambling before it gets to the point that it got for you and I. Basically, with the increased freedom, what can someone do or know ahead of time to minimize their risk of, you know, developing a gambling problem?
I think it's understanding the advertisements. Stop the advertising. It stops the normalization of it all. If you think of, I mean, I'm pretty sure it's the same in the States, but if you think about the UK market here, if I've just finished college or university and I've started a job, if I get up in the morning, I'm into sport and put Talk Sport on, I've got betting odds straight away at 6:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
I might then have to go to the gym where I'll have to go past two bookies to get to the gym. You then get home, you've Talk Sport on again, you've got more advertisements, you go on social media, it's gambling adverts. Even if you don't follow any of them, you're still going to get the adverts come up. You put something on YouTube, gambling adverts, you can't escape it. So, and this is why I feel it's so important to be educating 16 to 24 year olds based on lived experience, is these guys, the frontal lobe of the brain hasn't fully developed yet. So they can't manage risk correctly. If we're targeting them type of consumers, young people, with slogans like VIPs and winners, when what they actually mean is losers, then that's what I think we've got to do a lot of work around. It's helping young people realize that this is a dangerous product. If you look at, I mean, recently it started to change. In the last couple of months, I've seen one really good one on in the UK. But prior to that, any gambling advert you see on TV is going to have bright colours and comedy. Them two things. No reference to harm, apart from be gamble aware or take time to think, yeah. which is gone but like that, by the way. And when I was struggling with addiction, that did absolutely nothing for me. So really, I think now it's starting to be recognised as a public health issue in the UK and across the world. Where do you start to prevent that? You start with the advertising. Because whether you're on a tube in London, you see a taxi, it's everywhere. You cannot escape it. And that was one of the big factors for me in my own recovery. I used to go out and call myself an ex-gambling addict. And then someone said to me, what did you call yourself? I said, you're not an ex-gambler, you're a recovering gambling addict. And that person that said that to me played a massive part in my recovery without even realizing, because it was almost, they're right, I'm not an ex-gambling addict. I'm always going to be in recovery. Why? Because I can't escape the temptation or the advertisements or the marketing. So really, for me, I think it's about, I don't know whether you ever heard of Think, who do the public health campaign for drink driving?
No, we have like Mothers Against Drunk Driving here. That probably is the same thing.
I'll share some of their stuff with you, mate, because their advertisements are fantastic in terms of impact, reference to harm, being able to engage a younger audience. They're fantastic. And I think we need to start turning the screw and changing the mechanics behind how we advertise gambling in this country. Yes, we know that so many people enjoy socially gambling. It doesn't cause them any harm. But we've got to start thinking about the younger generation that are coming through that don't know anything different, but to just see gambling advertising be everywhere.
Yeah.
So for me, it'd be starting at that point. And all I mean by that, Rob, is there should be something at the end of 5 seconds of the advert. I'm not talking about huge changes to the advertisements, but something at the end that says, this is a dangerous product. Sure. This product can cause harm or can lead to death. Because in the UK, we had up to 496 related gambling suicides. So it's just like, if you would have seen a TV gambling advert, you wouldn't think that potentially 496 people took their lives due to gambling, because it doesn't mention anything about harm. This VIP lifestyle that looks dead luxury, that guarantees wins all the time, that doesn't cause any harm, that will use all these celebrities. I mean, I think it's Mark Wahlberg that does the Mike Iceberg, as he plays in America, isn't it, in the Ladbrokes advert?
I hadn't seen that. You know what? Interestingly, Mark Wahlberg particularly was supposed to be getting involved with something from the World Health Organization to combat gambling addiction. So if he is the one in those commercials, I would be pretty upset about it. I don't know that he is. I haven't seen that one. But it's just like, think that throwing something on the end is a good idea. One thing that I'd imagine that the gambling lobby in the United Kingdom, as well as everywhere on Earth, will say is, well, if we do that, we make our product less desirable. So then these black market sites like Stake and Bovada, they're going to advertise. Their advertisements are going to be better. We can't do that, Aaron, because it's going to make us less competitive in the international market. You know, what's a reasonable response to that if you hear that as an objection?
I don't think that could be used as an objection. when you can prove that people are taking their own lives from this product and you're not advertising the harm that can come of it. Just don't see how anyone could challenge it. I mean, there's times where I feel like I'm sort of banging my head against a brick wall a bit with it all. And there are, I know there's other organisations across the world that feel the same, but I mean, even if you had to, then move your advertisements to after 9 o'clock because it's an 18 plus product. And again, we've heard it, we hear it a lot, but I'm going to go back to it. It's cigarettes in the UK used to be advertised before 9, then after 9 because you had to be 18, and then they got rid of them completely. Alcohol is more of a seasonal advertisement. So if you get closer to Christmas, Easter, you may see some before 9 o'clock, but mostly after 9 o'clock. Gambling, 18 plus product, but we advertise it whenever they want and aggressively as well. It's not just the harm that it causes the individual, Rob. If you think about, I mean, and again, you know this yourself, for every person that suffers with gambling addiction, there's going to be 6 to 9 people that are also impacted or indirectly impacted, I should say, whether that be mom, dad, guardian, brothers, family, friends, etc. So you're not just looking after or trying to look after the potential addict. It's the wider impacts on that person, but then the impacts on economy as well. So, but as you know, mate, it's a very, very powerful industry. Gambling is hugely, hugely powerful industry, and it seems to get any change, it takes an awful long time. But thankfully, there are a number of organisations now across the globe that seem to be doing a really, really good job, mate. So hopefully we get there sooner than we anticipate.
Yeah, I hope so too. And just to backtrack, you know, I don't actually think that's a reasonable objection. It's just the objection that I hear all the time, which is like, we have to remain financially competitive with these black market companies. And it's like the main cop out from casinos at this point. What I think is the truth is, like, you have to call a shit sandwich. I heard someone say this. You have to call a shit sandwich a shit sandwich. And like, the stuff that the black market groups do is the same stuff that the regulated groups do. Yeah, it's just that the state doesn't get their cut. And we have to say, like, both of these groups are doing something horrible. So the regulation needs to come on both of the groups. Steering back into things that, you know, maybe someone clicked onto this video for, maybe they want to hear about how you got yourself away from gambling personally. What was it that made you stop? And what is it that, you know, in addition to everything we've talked about thus far, what is it that helps you to sustain your recovery?
So there were a few sort of main factors to mine. I think firstly, opening up for the first time to my mom and actually seeking help. So I spoke to 2 or 3 counsellors and a psychologist. And it was actually the cheapest counsellor out of all of them, who was the youngest, was the one that I was able to relate to. Why? Because he had had gambling addiction in the family. And when if you're able to relate to someone, you're more likely to open up. And with that person, they just got me. They understood me. And I say this to the students when we go out and do sessions now, it's not one of them situations where 1 minute I'm really struggling, then I'm the granddad off Willy Wonka jumping around the bedroom saying I'm cured. Because there were times throughout specifically the first 6 months of my recovery where I would be thinking about betting or putting a bet on, I was really, really struggling at the early stages. But it was actually talking to somebody consistently and also working on my own physical and mental health. So it was, for me, I had to occupy times of boredom, because if I was sat and not doing anything, that would often lead to gambling for me. So throughout the lockdown period, I'd be out walking at the weekends doing sort of 15, 20 miles and spending quite a lot of time outdoors and in the gym and working on myself. And that's what this counsellor actually got me doing. It was thinking about myself. For 10, 12 years, all I'd worried about was this perception on social media I'd built up wasn't actually real, but I didn't want anyone to know about that. And now it was time to actually start looking after myself instead of worrying about what other people are thinking about me. So in addition to concentrating on myself and my own sort of physical and mental well-being, consistently talking to someone twice a week, making sure I was occupied, finding out how much money I'd lost was another one, Rob. So 6 months into it, I found out that, as I said earlier, I'd lost over £250,000. And I'd had absolutely no idea that it was that amount. So that was another factor in me wanting to do something about it. And then, sorry, the final one was coming across Jack Ritchie's story in The Guardian, who was a young fella that had taken his own life, unfortunately, due to gambling addiction. And his mum and dad had then set up a charity called Gambling With Lives that was all about supporting bereaved families. And no joke, mate, I went through Jack's story, and there were so many similarities between the age he started gambling, how he got into it, like, so much, mate. And I just thought to myself when I read that, I've spent 10, 12 years recruiting into colleges and helping educational organisations in this country with staff. And I thought, right, I'm just going to open up about it properly and to clients while I still had my job. And I went out and I sort of tell them my story, tell them about the idea of Against the Odds. And it went down really well with a lot of people. So I then started going out and delivering my first sessions into secondary schools and colleges. And what them sessions looked like were, they were a breakdown of my story. So leaving school, going to college, but we explored the mental, physical and financial impacts after college, after university and after employment, looking for key triggers throughout and things like that. And then the second part was a sort of a deep dive into the industry. So why we see celebrities advertise it, why we see more shops in deprived areas opposed to affluent, why we see aggressive advertising, the unhealthy relationship with elite sport, MPs in this country taking backhanders from the industry. So we tried to cover quite a lot in an hour. But yeah, they were the main sort of drivers, mate, really. Opening up for the first time, getting things off my chest, consistently talking about it, occupying my time when I'd otherwise be bored. And then sort of seeing similar stories of people that had struggled like myself that were unfortunately no longer here were really sort of the wake-up calls, if you like, for me to go on to now be at 3 years and 9 months.
Well, congrats on that. That's fantastic.
Thank you very much, mate.
I think a good way of kind of describing the feel that you want to accomplish, the goals that you want to accomplish with Against the Odds, if a young man or woman walks into a session with you for the very first time, they sit for an hour, they hear you out, and they go home, what do you want them to feel when they walk away from that session?
So we've got two lesson objectives from our workshops. Depending, obviously, which workshop you're attending, but a normal 16 to 24-year-old at a college or a university, we'd want them to go away with two things. So number one, if you are struggling with something, then it hasn't got to be gambling related or not. It can be gambling, it cannot be. If you're struggling with something, then have the confidence in yourself to open up to somebody that you trust and get it off your chest and seek help with it, opposed to trying to deal with it yourself. Second lesson objective is to identify the transition of social gambling, so having fun, to gambling related harm, and what those early trigger points might look like. So they're the two things we try and take students to take away, and we'll recap that at the end of every session. So what does that transition look like from social gambling to gambling related harm, and what them early points may look like? And then if you've got an issue gambling related or not, being confident in opening up to someone about that, despite how scared you are or how big it may feel, is just opening up to someone and making sure you talk to someone and the impact that can have instead of not doing that.
Sure. And over the next, 5-10 years, if everything goes according to plan, what do you hope to accomplish?
Well, I'd love to grow the team out, firstly. So we've started to do that already. But at the minute, we've got maybe two or three of us in the business, me being full-time and two others being part-time. But we want to be a brand that is known throughout the United Kingdom, especially within 16 to 24-year-olds. And we want to be similar to what you've done in America, Rob, to be honest with you, mate. You've built a brilliant social media platform, whereas if I was a young person in America struggling with gambling, I would think of you straight away. And that's what we're trying to portray over here. If you're struggling with gambling in this country and you're a young person, whether you play elite sports, whether you're at college, whether you're at university, or whether you're at secondary school and about to head off to college, if you're facing gambling related harm indirectly or directly and you don't know what to do, then we just reach out to us, because if we can't help you directly, we can put you in contact with somebody that can, whether that's groups, whether that's a telephone call. Being that brand that young people can associate with, oh, I'm struggling with my gambling, I'm going to go to them. That's the aim for us, right, really, to be honest.
That's awesome. And of course, we're going to link all of your social media and all of your information in the description of this video. So if you are watching this video and you're resonating with what Aaron's talking about, make sure you check that out. Before we wrap up today, I want to leave with one question that is kind of top of mind for me simply because of what I do for work. What is the grand impact of the way that social media portrays gambling? If I look at my comments, likely a comment on this video, someone said something to the extent of, just keep going, you'll get the win that'll solve all your problems. What is the impact that you see happening as a result of the way we treat gambling online?
Wow.
Ignore that.
I'll go back to it, mate. It's just been normalized. Because the fact that it's everywhere, and I mean everywhere, young people feel that to gamble is normal. Young people are unable to identify what gambling harm is. They just think this is normal. It's a really tricky one, but the impact that social media is having on young people particularly is the wrong one, a negative one. Because like you say, Rob, I've put videos up on YouTube and things like that before, and you get the same comments. And I don't know whether they're bots that just push this stuff out to try and keep people doing it. I've got absolutely no idea, but we need to get people like me and you need to get young people to be able to relate or engage with our type of content. Because if we can get them to relate and engage to it, then they feel more comfortable in opening up. What we need to stop doing is this corporate approach to gambling addiction awareness or education. Because young people switch off and they don't find it interesting. So hopefully younger, and I use the phrase younger for both of us, Rob. However, I'm sure you're significantly younger than myself, mate. You look it anyway. Me and you need to just keep banging that drum and keep trying to engage young people via social media to have the adverse effect that it's having at the minute, which is a negative one. And that's normalizing gambling, making people and individuals think that this is a luxury product where everyone could be a winner and it's glamorous. And there's a lot, the lifestyle Drake will portray with, it's just all the wrong messaging to be sending to young people. And
if you could go back and talk to yourself in that transitionary period from living with the family to going off to school and, you know, getting that increased finances, increased freedom, what do you think is something that you could have said that would have resonated other than just like, don't gamble? Because I feel like that's too easy of an answer.
I wish I would have understood the impacts longer term. So I don't know about you, but in the UK, you don't get taught about interest, credit cards, mortgages, loans. However, you do a fair chunk of time learning about Pi and Pythagoras and all that sort of stuff, which I've never needed, strangely enough. But if I would have knew that me going into a bookies at 16 and having an addictive personality would have meant that I could have been on 65 grand a year 8 years later and been unable to get a phone contract for £30 a month, or what a default would look like when that hit my account and didn't move for 6 years, or how when I'd come to the age of 29, I'd still be able to struggle to buy a house on my own despite me earning so much money, or the fact that I'd be self-harming in my mum's bedroom. So if I would have known the longer term impacts, if I carried on what was actually going to happen, then that could have potentially made a difference for me, because I was never going to open up to my mum. My mum was like my best friend. I was never going to open up to her. So did anyone come in and educate me studying sport for 5.5 years at college and university? No. No one came in to talk about gambling. Not one person. I played county sports, rugby and cricket. No one ever came in to talk about gambling. So it was very much one of them where we've got Gambling Anonymous over here, or I'm just not going to say anything. So what does that come down to? It comes down to how we advertise the product now. It comes down to how we educate young people. In my opinion, it should be compulsory post-16 in all colleges and universities. We have universities that they understand what can lead from the transition of social to gambling harm. So yeah, to cut a long story short, mate, what would I have told myself was, knowing what I know now, is just think about your longer term vision in life. Life is only short. I'm halfway through my life now and I've wasted 10 years of it gambling.
Fantastic. I mean, being able to do the thing that would have helped you in the past is exactly my motivation for doing what I do here. So I'm happy to hear that you're doing it. Wishing you the best of success in the future. Thank you for taking the time to join me today. And if you're in the audience and you want to hear a story of someone else who's in recovery from gambling addiction, then check out this video. Let's keep getting better together, one day at a time.